We received apologies from the Honorable Master Shiwe. He's in Canada, abroad, 14 hours from here. The other one is Honorable Mashile on his way back from Lesotho. The third one is Honorable Makubela attending a meeting? Security meeting. And then there's a strategy planning meeting for the budgetary debate on corporate governance. So we are a bit depleted, but other members will join us. So welcome to everyone. The apologies can we get accepted? Thank you, Honorable Becker. My name is Charles De Beer, chairperson of the Select Committee for Finance, and also member of the Select Committee for Appropriations and the Constitutional Review. I just want the other members to introduce themselves. There's the faces in front of us, some are new. Others we know.
Good morning, gentlemen, ladies. My name is Debo Ochani, a member of this committee.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Jacques Becker. I'm a member of this committee. I'm from the Western Cape.
Honourable members, thank you very much. The what we're dealing with is in the agenda, the annual reports of the Reserve Bank, as well as the combined annual report of the supervisors of the Cooperative Banks Development Agency and the Reserve Bank. You'll see the date there, the year 2010-2011. That's 14 months ago. So we're actually going to deal with history. This was referred to us on the 15th of May, and I've got the referral here, 2012. And there's a problem in Parliament in terms of the process of referrals. It came also out yesterday in the budget vote of Parliament. And I addressed this issue with the chairperson in the NCOP for committees and oversight, Honorable Papi Tau, as well as the program whip, Honorable Mashishiwe, as well as the Standing Committee Chairperson for Finance in the National Assembly, Honorable Taba Mufamadi, and the whip of the Finance Committee in the National Assembly, Honorable Des van Rooyen. The researchers told me that this will be an agenda point when they do their analysis of the procedures in Parliament to improve processes. But this is unacceptable, and my proposal is, and I spoke to the Honorable Chairperson of Mufamadi, that when the annual report of the banks or the institutions are tabled in Parliament that we are working with, we do it jointly to save time and not to work with history. So I just want to put that on the table to give you clarity that I don't think this is what we want. But thank you for coming to address us. We're going straight into the business and give the opportunity to the supervisors of the Cooperative Banks Development Agency. Please introduce yourself. The men are outnumbering the ladies. Luckily, the Gender Commission is not present. But you are all welcome. Introduce yourself, and then you can get into the business. The documentation was circulated to honorable members. I hope they read through it. It's quite interesting. Over to you, sir. And we're going to give you time until 20 past 10.
Yes.
Maybe a bit longer.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. My name is Nkosana Mashia, and I'm the Deputy Registrar of Banks, but I'm also the Supervisor of Cooperative Banks. So I've got a dual role there. And then I'll let my colleagues start a little bit. I'll come back a little bit, Chairperson, just to suggest some changes in the presentation. We'll stick within the time limit, but there's just one additional change I would like to suggest.
I'll give you 5 minutes. There's my camera.
Thank you, Chairperson. My name is David Dion. I'm the supervisor of Cooperative Banks, based at the Cooperative Banks Development Agency.
Morning, Chair. Morning, everyone. My name is Ola Osamatane. I'm the MD of the Cooperative Banks Development Agency.
Okay, so Chairperson, just to clarify the confusion about so many responsibilities, and this is part of the reason I'm going to make this suggestion. So the way that the supervision of cooperative banks is currently structured in terms of the Cooperative Bank Act is that the Minister of Finance is required to appoint two supervisors of cooperative banks. And the main reason for this is that there is a huge difference in the size, discrepancy in the size of cooperative banks. So short of sharing the workload, the supervisor in the Reserve Bank is responsible for supervising all the larger primary cooperative banks. We're going to begin to that. And then the supervisor in, and then also the secondary cooperatives and the tertiary cooperative banks. And then the supervisor in the Cooperative Banks Development Agency is responsible for the upcoming smaller cooperative banks. So what we typically do then is to create just one joint report that we issue to the Minister of Finance as well as to Parliament. Now, the way I'm going to suggest is that I can see that the Honorable Committee requested that we give a report back only on the joint supervisor's report, but I'm of the opinion that the committee would get benefit into receiving the report of the CBDA as well, which houses the agency. Now, both presentations will be less than 15 minutes, so we'll still be into your session. Okay.
That is our first engagement with you as the team of your
country. Thank you.
So it will be very important.
Okay. Yes, we hope so.
Okay, thank you, Chair, for this opportunity. I hope this is clear for everyone.
Yes, please proceed.
As Mr. Mashia has indicated, the supervisor of the smaller cooperative banks resides within the Cooperative Bank Development Agency. So I'm going to give the context of what the agency does so that when the joint supervisors present their report, you can understand the bigger picture. My presentation will look at the establishment and mandate of the CBDA, the Cooperative Bank Supervisors Report, very briefly. The capacity building and information report, the status of the CFI sector, the report of the audit committee and the auditor general, as well as the financial statement. Now, as the committee may be aware, the Cooperative Bank Development Act was passed in 2007. However, the operations of the agency started first with the appointment of the board in August 2008, and the first MD was appointed in March 2009. Unfortunately, our first MD resigned in March 2011. And in May 2009, our supervisor, Mr. Leong, was then appointed. Now, Section 54.1 of the Cooperative Bank Development Act establishes the CBDA, and it mentions that it will be accountable to the PFMA. Section 55 of the Act then lays down all the responsibilities of the CBDA. So, for example, our mandate is to support, promote, and develop cooperative banks, to appoint a supervisor, and that is Mr. Dion, to promote establishment of representative bodies. This is covered from Section 31 to Section 33 of the Act, to accredit and regulate support organizations. That is covered in Section 36 to 38 of the Act. So those sections, they explain what the representative body needs to look like, how they need to conduct themselves, and what does it take for them to get accepted. Now, since this is the 2010-11 annual report, this is how the organization looks at the end of March 2011. The agency has got a board of directors, And then the managing director at that time was Ms. Sharda Naidu, who was unfortunately left. And then the agency consists of two main responsibilities. It's got the dual responsibility of supervision and regulation, and of capacity building and development. So these are the two main responsibilities of the agency. Now briefly, the cooperative bank supervisor's report. The supervisor has two main responsibilities. The first one is that of regulation, and the second one is that of supervision. So the regulatory responsibilities is mainly to make rules and enforce compliance with the legislation, being the Cooperative Bank Development Act. In terms of supervision, the supervisor is required to make on and off-site visits, establish and ensure that the cooperative banks are financially sound and stable, and therefore ensure corrective action if there are any problems. The strategic goals for the supervisor: 1, to register and supervise cooperative banks; 2, enforce compliance and review the legislative framework if and when necessary; and 3, how to handle trouble banks, either to help them or to place them down if necessary. So these three strategic goals are based on these main responsibilities of regulation and supervision. Now, the first strategic goal, that of registration and supervision of cooperative banks, the supervisor has to maintain processes for screening of licensing applications. The supervisor evaluates applications of proposed cooperative banks. You will see on page 16 of the annual report a list of 18 CFIs eligible to apply for registration. Eligibility: the minimum requirement is 200 members, 1 million worth of deposits. But then after that, there's a list of prudential requirements that they have to adhere to, and that the supervisor will explain in his report. The supervisor will carry out scheduled and targeted on-site examinations and off-site analysis of property funds. The second strategic goal of the supervisor: compliance work and review of legislative framework. Here the Act gives the supervisor power to issue guidance notes, to issue regulations and rules. These are meant to provide guidance to applicants in terms of what is needed for them to apply as cooperative banks or to register as cooperative financial institutions. Now, there is what we call the Regulatory and Oversight Advisory Committee. This consists of the sub-supervisor as well as the CBDA supervisor. Hence, later on, they'll be making their joint presentation. The Registrar Cooperative, because financial cooperatives, they first register as cooperatives before they can register as cooperative financial institutions. Now, this committee is meant to review, develop policy and legislation, and coordinate efforts between the two supervisors, the registrar and the CBDA. So far, the committee has reviewed unintended consequences and possible amendments to the Act. The supervisor in his presentation will talk more about that. Furthermore, the supervisor participates in national and international regulatory and supervisory forums just to learn how other countries do, how other regulators do their regulation, how the landscape of regulation and supervision is changing worldwide. And then also the Act requires that there be an annual cooperation and coordination plan, and that is what will be presented later. Now, as you saw in the organogram, there are two main divisions within the agency: that of regulation and supervision, and that of capacity building and information. Now I'll move on to capacity building. The strategic goals and objectives of this unit were firstly to assemble a team which is there already. There's a director with two deputy directors to facilitate the capacity building initiatives of the agency. They need to understand existing CFI sector in depth so that the interventions are targeted and relevant to what the problems of the sector are. The third goal and objective is to support, promote and develop cooperative banks, to develop programs to meet sector learning needs, and to implement the CFI development monitoring system. Now this team within the capacity building unit, they are assigned to develop accredited training materials. They've already achieved that. To develop capacity building tools, they've already achieved that. Facilitate workshops, they've already done that. They facilitated workshops with SAMAP, which is now FIFA, and also with the bank FIFA. Provide technical assistance to CFIs and the bank services. I'm glad to say they have achieved all of these assignments. Now, as part of understanding the existing CFI sector in depth, there was a questionnaire that was circulated via SAMAF, which was then the regulator of CFI, and via SACOL. 67 returns were received from 6 provinces. Now, in the results, this indicated the skills level of the employees of the CFIs as well as the board members of the CFIs. Only 15% of the respondents had university qualifications, 32% had college diplomas, 63% had high school education, 67% fairly new and have not attended any CFI related training, which is really a wide range. I'll later on, when I talk about the CFI sector, indicate the problems we have in the sector. One of the strategic goals to support, promote, and develop cooperative banks, including deposit taking cooperatives. Now, service providers were appointed and developed standardized manual accounting systems as well as governance training materials. And some of these have already been delivered to the CFI. Another strategic goal to implement the CFI development monitoring system. Now, what the team has done in the 2010-11 financial year, they conducted on-site technical assistance to CFI, and this has to do with the production of financial statements. The unit assisted CFI with the review and development of new strategic plans. Now, this is one of the requirements for pre-registration as a CFI. You must have a strategic plan that indicates clearly the goals of the CFI, what the loan policy is, what the savings policy is. The unit has also formed a capacity building guidance committee, which is similar to the ROAC in the supervision committee. This committee consists of the CDDA, SAMAF, which is now called FIFA after the merger, SACOL, DGRD, which is a German think tank, and the bank FIFA. The purpose of the committee is to ensure coordinated and comprehensive approach to education and training in the country. So what we want to avoid is for the bank FIFA to go off and do training that the CDDA doesn't know about, or SACOL to go off and do training that the SAMAF doesn't know about. So this is to coordinate all the efforts and initiatives with regards to the training and capacity building in the sector. Now, Chair, this is just for a brief background of the status of the CFI sector and emerging observations that we find. Firstly, weak and inadequate capital levels, weak governance structures where the majority of the CFIs don't hold AGMs, board members have been there for too long, and they've inadequate training, they lack understanding of the financial cooperative model. Also, the major thing that has also emerged is inadequate credit risk management practices. FSCs, conservative lending, this affects the growth and sustainability of the FSCs, because without lending, they are able to make an income for them to become a growing concern. The support aggressive lending, that's fine, it helps them with sustainability. Some of these institutions, we didn't have any credit committees to provide oversight over their lending. This is a big risk. Some of them had inadequate capabilities in monitoring and managing delinquent loans, and this led to the demise of most of these people. Most of the CFIs, we found out that they have weak operational capacity. Some of them are still on a manual paper-based system. Inadequate skills as reflected in the slides of the percentages that I just went through. And one of the most important ones now is reporting on financial performance. What was found was that most of the SSCs do not produce conventional financial statements. They only tend to report for grant funding purposes. SACOL were not consistently reporting for SACOL, which is their APEC organization that is supposed to self-regulate and therefore regulate the sector. Lack of accounting skills, and therefore hence they couldn't manage with regards to compilation of financial statements. Unaudited financial statements, they cannot prioritize by auditors also. Firstly, they didn't have the time as these institutions are so small and they require a different kind of auditing. Properties then cannot be audited by the audit any other institution. Last and finally, to come to the annual financial statement. Firstly, you'll see in the annual report, there's a report there at the back of the audit committee. The audit committee was happy that the CBDA's internal controls, the auditors, can show reliable financial records. Financial statements were prepared on the basis of appropriate accounting policies, and that also our financial statements comply with the relevant provisions of the CFMA. However, as you will see, the report of the Auditor General had a few concerns. However, firstly, let's note that the report of the Auditor General was unqualified, so they were happy with the audit. There were a few matters of emphasis, irregular expenditure, fruitless and wasteful expenditure, but these were things really that were beyond the control of the agency. We can go into further detail later if members are interested. There was also the issue of compliance with laws and regulations, but really these were minor issues where the agency would contact the supplier and their tax clearance certificate would be in place. And then by the time the work is done and we are supposed to pay the supplier, the certificate has expired. So it seems like that they were really beyond the control of the agency. One of the issues you will note there, there is no deposit insurance fund, which is one of the requirements stated in the Act. In this instance, really, the agency is in the hands of the National Treasury, where they are the ones drafting the policy. My understanding is that the policy for the fund is done, but it just needs to go through a few approvals. The statement of financial position, I don't know if the committee wants me to go through the details of this. However, this accumulated deficit, it contains about 300 million that was rolled over from the 2009-2010 financial year. About 300,000 is the rollover from the 2009-2010 financial year, where we were using the National Treasury Bank account. National Treasury was on a cash basis, we were on an accrual basis. So at the end of March, they closed their books and we still had liabilities that we had to pay. And that resulted in an accounting deficit. So we had money in the bank, but Treasury wouldn't let us access the money. And then the other accumulated deficit was overspending by the regions of about 400 pounds. In terms of the revenue, the agency received 8.2 million from National Treasury as a transfer, spending on goods and services, compensation to employees was the main expenditure. The budget was not enough for the agency to do any other thing. And then this deficit for the year is where the agency overspent on some of their goods and services. That's all from me, Chair. Clearly, the CBDA has an opportunity to support this sector and ensure its sustainability and viability. The sector is showing definite growth and needs to ensure that it is regulated and does not put the deposit of the. Thank you. David will now present the combined supervisor.
Thanks, honourable members. If I can perhaps take the process forward, the outline that we have, and I must say that well, I covered some of the bits that I was.
Just before you start, do we have a hard copy?
It seems that you don't have a hard copy.
No.
The actual report, that we submitted.
That we have.
Yep. In fact, I'm quite pleased. This report was circulated. I emailed it. However, copies of it weren't made. And then this morning I was asked when I was inside the room whether I could please circulate copies.
When was it emailed?
Yesterday.
Emailed yesterday. Did you receive it? You're going to be able to split the tree about that now. Please carry on. Try and follow as you speak.
What this presentation does is it just looks a little bit at what are cooperative banks, so we develop a common understanding of what they are, how they're structured, and how they're tiered. I then, because this is quite historical, our first report that we presented did look at the history of the Cooperative Banks Act, how it unfolded and how, where it came from, because all of this started more or less in 2002 already. And then it looks at the point where we are now, where in fact we've registered the first cooperative bank. In fact, we've now registered two. So it does look at some of the historical. So it looks at the history, it looks at preparation, preparing for implementation, and then the actual implementation. I also have a slide on the primary reasons for failure to register, but I think that was adequately covered earlier in the earlier presentation. The main reason why we're here today is because one of the requirements of the Cooperative Banks Act is that the supervisors provide a combined annual report to the minister, which must be presented to Parliament. And in fact, that was the combined annual report that was presented. So I provide a little bit around that as well. And then finally, the end of our report looks at some of the issues requiring attention for 2011 and 2012. So again, just highlighting the Act, saying that we're required to present a joint supervisor's report, basically which outlines the powers and functions of the supervisors and how we carried out those powers and functions. And our powers and functions include registering and deregistering cooperative banks, issuing rules, guidance notes and directives, issuing penalties if required, carrying out inspections, and taking any other steps necessary to provide members public funds. Now, I think there's a little bit sometimes of a misconception about what are cooperative banks, and people think of them as mainstream cooperative banks. The Act talks about cooperative banks having to have what's called a common bond. And it requires that people must either work together, they should belong to a common association, or they should live together in the same geographic district. Furthermore, the Cooperative Banks Act requires that once those particular groups with the common bond reach 200 members and 1 million deposits, they're required to come and register or apply for registration as a cooperative bank. It's not automatic that when you come and apply, you're going to be registered as a cooperative bank. And I think that's been a key issue. We also have what are called secondary and tertiary cooperative banks. And the secondary and tertiary are made up of two or more cooperative banks coming together. So they're made up of entities as opposed to your primary cooperative banks, which are made up of individual members or natural persons. That being the key difference. So it's a tiered structure. Again, the types of cooperative banks that the Act allows for are primary savings, and I'll talk later about what they do. Then there's primary savings and loans. There's what's referred to as secondary cooperative banks and what's referred to as tertiary cooperative banks. So we have a look at the services of these various cooperatives and cooperative banks. A savings-only cooperative can take deposits, it can open up savings accounts for its members, it can borrow money, it can open up accounts in the name of the cooperative, it can draw and accept and negotiate with various instruments, it can open up trust and custody services, and then G says it can also do additional banking services, if so prescribed by the Minister of Finance. And it can also invest money in investments prescribed by the minister. And the investments... Oh, sorry. And these investments are very strictly regulated. Largely, the financial cooperatives or the cooperative banks are not allowed to speculate with members' money. All investments must be in investments which provide a guaranteed return. A primary savings and loans cooperative can do exactly what a primary savings cooperative would do, but B, essentially being the big difference, is that it's also allowed to give out loans up to a minimum aggregate value, or maximum, sorry, aggregate value. And currently that's 80% of the deposits can be given out by a cooperative bank in loans. And that's its real business. It mobilizes savings, and from the savings that it mobilizes, it can then give out 80% of its deposits out on loan. And that's really what these cooperative banks are all about. They're not about investing money in speculative investments, in big instruments to try and get the best return. It's to circulate members' money back in the communities in which are doing the savings mobilization to get so they can get out loans. And then again, D is conduct any additional banking services and invest money deposited in any investments, again, as prescribed by the minister. So those are your two primary cooperatives, and then you have a secondary and tertiary cooperative. Your secondary and tertiary cooperatives are allowed to trade in instruments, being the key difference, because they are now they're working with the juristic entities of other cooperatives. They're allowed to pool money and then invest those pooled money in other instruments, and that's largely the difference. The other big difference is that the secondary and tertiary cooperatives can also enter the national payment system and are also able to provide transactional services to the cooperative banks themselves. So what we have is a tiered structure, and the tiered structure is based on the Cooperatives Act. The Cooperatives Act identified three different tiers, being the primary, secondary, and apex cooperatives. And as Ola said, that the every single cooperative bank or financial cooperative must first register as a cooperative, and once it's registered as a cooperative, it must then come and register under the Cooperative Banks Act, which sits on top of the Cooperatives Act. And if you have between 1 million rand and 200 members, you must come and register with myself at the Cooperative Banks Development Agency. And if you have more than 20 million, you then become regulated by Sama Mashiach, the Reserve Bank. So the Reserve Bank takes the larger cooperatives. The initial cooperatives are seen as being incubated. We provide what we call light touch supervision. We try and assist them. Unlike perhaps the Reserve Bank, they would be much more legalistic in the application of the law in terms of registration of these financial cooperatives. We are a little bit more, I don't want to say lenient, but we would go back and we wouldn't say resubmit your entire application. We'll say, why don't you address this issue, this issue, this issue, and we can re-look at it. So that's a little bit of the difference, and I think that was the intent of the Act, was to try and assist these community groups to be able to apply and to grow. Again, the history for some of the members, I'm sure you, most of you are aware of it, was that in 2002 there was a financial sector summit held at NEDLAC. There was agreement that there would be a reform and that would include cooperative banking legislation. There was the Presidential Growth Summit in 2003 where there was an emphasis on cooperatives broadly and cooperative banks specifically. The Cooperatives Act in 2005 was replaced from the 1981 Cooperatives Act, which was very agricultural focused. The 2005 Act allowed trading cooperatives as well as financial cooperatives, worker cooperatives, and all other types of cooperatives. Also, in 2005, it was moved from the Department of Agriculture, where the old cooperatives used to be registered, to the CIPRO, which is now CIPCC. So, and once that had happened, then the Cooperative Banks Act could be could go through Parliament, because they first need the Cooperatives Act to be amended. But in 2004, there was a Cooperative Banks Bill, and there were various Bank Act exemption notices that were issued in 2006 and 2008. So once the Act was tabled before Parliament, there was some preparation that began already. It began with the sector, so there was large consultation with the sector, even from a supervisory point of view, to make sure that the sector was on board. We had the Act, which was then finally tabled to Parliament in 2008 and came through the NCOP as well and was approved by the NCOP. Draft regulations around the Act were drafted in August 2008. The CBDA board was appointed in August 2008. The MD was appointed in March. I was appointed in 2009, or May of 2009. Andre Bezaden was the first supervisor of Cooperative Banks appointed in the South African Reserve Bank. And he was then, and then Yvette Singh replaced him for about 6 months. And Nkosana Mashiya has now taken over since January of this year was appointed as the supervisor of Cooperative Banks in the South African Reserve Bank. And then in December 2009, the big thing that happened with us was that we had a huge consultative conference with all eligible financial cooperatives and discussed the rules with them, discussed the regulations with them, discussed the registration process so that they were all on board to make sure that they all understood as required. In January 2010, we published the rules. And we published a guidance note as to how to apply to register as a cooperative. So in that period, we had 17 eligible applicants that applied for registration as... Sorry, thank you. We had 17 eligible applicants that applied. They had a total asset value of about 180 million between them. 13 fell between the 1 million and the 20 million, and so they were assessed by the CBDA, and 4 were assessed by the South African Reserve Bank, which included one secondary cooperative bank. They had a total deposits of about 160 million, and the total assets was around 180 million. Their total membership was around 28,000. 11 of the 17 applications were completed, so there were 6 that we actually couldn't do proper assessments on because they came through really badly. And the first cooperative bank, the Tabotla Savings and Credit Cooperative Bank, was registered on the 17th of February 2011. The Tabotla is based in Lichtenburg in the Northwest Province. And the SARB, during this particular reporting period, had already given approval to the second cooperative bank to be registered. That particular one was Aranya, cooperative bank based in Northwest Province. In the Northern Cape. But their application wasn't approved during this particular period. It was only approved in June. There you go. So you know the crew. The old man, Mr. Bossoff, he initiated it. His son has taken it over, I understand. So that's where we were during this particular period. Then the reasons for failure. I'm repeating Ms. Moshane has raised already. But the main reasons why we have failed to register was inadequate capital level. The capital requirement is 6%. Now, if you think the banks is 10%. And yet many of the financial cooperatives, because they've been operating at losses for a while, and our biggest problem has actually been provisioning, is that their balance sheets are not reflecting the truth, because while they're reflecting maybe 100,000 rand in loans, what they're not telling us is 200,000 rand they're reflecting 1 million rand in loans, they're not reflecting that 200,000 of those loans are bad. And once we start putting provisioning in, we find that it brings the capital adequacy ratios right down. And in fact, many of them are then technically insolvent if we had to actually build in that. So this is our biggest problem at the moment, because of the 18 that have applied, there's around about 14 that don't meet that 6%. And even there, we're not like fixed on the 6%. If it's 3% and we can see that there's potential for real growth, we'll still register it well, there's a high probability we'll still register. We're talking about many of them just operating at 0% or having no additional capital, barely being solvent. And then weak governance and operational capacity. You know, as carpenters, they must hold AGMs, they must have meetings, they must have systems in place. Poor accounting at MIS, Management Information Systems, few qualified accounting staff, and very, very few, more particularly the rural carpenters. In fact, most of the rural carpenters, none of them are, at this time, computerized. They're all operating on manual accounting systems, which, again, in terms of reporting requirements, is going to make it quite difficult for them to submit their returns as we require them. Right, then, between the CBDA and the SOB, to ensure that we work well together and that we aren't doing different things, the Act requires that we have a cooperation agreement in place. So we have a coordinated approach towards supervision, that we engage with each other regularly, that we have staff exchanges, and we provide technical expertise and assistance to one another. In all honesty, we've had an excellent, excellent working relationship with the cooperative supervision unit at the SOB. As you'll see, we actually meet weekly. We have weekly meetings with the SOB every Monday morning from 9 till around about, well, hopefully there's not big issues, we're going to be finished by half past 10. You know, but we go through our programs, we discuss with each other what we're doing. There's an excellent understanding. We hold joint meetings when we meet with, for example, the Financial Intelligence Center, if we meet with the National Credit Regulator, when we meet with SUMUP, when we meet with other organizations, we attend these jointly. We've put our joint publications, we put out the rules together. When we put out the rules and the regulation, they were the supervisors' joint rules and the supervisors' joint regulations. We've commented together on, for example, the Carpenters Act, which is currently also under amendment. So again, we put in joint comments. When we even assess applications, we have a joint committee that looks at the application, because the hope is, of course, that once it rests with us, it will soon go into the SOB, so they also want to be part of that decision, and we have no issues about that. And we've done joint presentations as well to international and local seminars. In Africa, there are only two countries during this period that actually adopted financial cooperative legislation. That was ourselves, and a month later it was Kenya. And the rest of the continent has been extremely interested in adopting a regulatory regime for what they call their SACOs, their savings and credit cooperatives, or often also known as credit unions. And so we're continually invited to seminars around Africa to do presentations on what we've done. Issues requiring attention during this particular reporting period was during 2011, was the Banks Act exemption notices. I can just explain that below 1 million, we also have financial cooperatives operating. And because they're deposit-taking, they've got to do it legally through the Banks Act. And so what the bank has done is they've issued what are called Bank Act exemption notices. And they issued it to two organizations, SACOL and to SUMUP, which is now CIFA. And we were really having problems with SACOL and CIFA's regulation or regulating all those small institutions. Because from the Register of Cooperatives, we've got a list of 161 such institutions operating there. And we're getting a lot of report of failures happening. Even though they were small, they still affect the small community. There's a loss of 500,000 Rand or 200,000 Rand. So we had a lot of discussion around what to do about the exemption notice. And in fact, because some have closed, and because some have closed, and because SACOL is unable to do it, they've given the exemption notice now to the CBDA. And in fact, we're going to take over the exemption notice, and we're going to regulate the smaller ones as well. The Deposit Insurance Fund, the Act requires that there should be a Deposit Insurance Fund implemented, and again, as Ola said, it's not there yet, and you know, we feel very strongly that one of the motivating forces of members joining a financial cooperative will be that their money is guaranteed, which is something banks don't give at the moment. So it would be the explicit deposit insurance, but it hasn't been implemented as yet. Potential abuse of the Act. People see this as a backdoor to the Banks Act. And so we have many companies telling us they want to establish cooperative banks. When we go and investigate them, they don't even know what cooperative principles are. And it's quite frightening, actually. That's what has become one of our biggest challenges. We have many people phoning us. And, you know, people They listen to government's programs around cooperative development, so they all want to do things for cooperatives, not understanding that cooperatives are self-help organizations. They do it for themselves. Anyway, also, we meant to have established an appeals board, and again, National Treasury, in fact, meant to have established an appeals board, which has not as yet been established, but we haven't had any appeals yet, and I don't think it will be difficult for them to establish an appeals board if there was such an appeal. Submission of prudential returns. At the moment, everything is paper-based, and we want to move towards a system where it will be electronically based, and people can make submissions on a portal through the internet. We're working on that at the moment with SOB, and in fact, the system has been designed. And then there's the Twin Peaks Model Financial Regulation, which was just which was published in 2011 by National Treasury. And the Twin Peaks essentially argues for a single regulator of all prudential regulation, and on the other side, the consumer regulation happening more through the FSB. And the implication of that would be that the CBDA supervisor would be merged into the SOB, and in fact there would only be one supervisor, there wouldn't be two anymore, and the idea is to put everything underneath the SOB. So that's going forward quite strongly at the moment. And then the final one is that Basel published core principles on banking supervision specifically for microfinance deposit-taking institutions, recognizing that they're different to banks and that they need to be treated differently in terms of their supervision methodology. It was a document which came out during this particular year, 2011-2012, and between the two supervisory departments, we've been aligning our regulatory and supervisory practices to meet the requirements of that particular document, which has now come out. Thanks very much.
Action plan to correct. Where the challenges are less than that,
okay.
You don't see the action plan. So I think
okay.
That
the
Deputy Governor of the Reserve Bank is here. Hello, welcome. Dr. O.T. here. The Chief General of the Committee. So we can continue to your presentation. And we will keep the time to take part of it.
Thank you very much, Chair. It's an honor to be back here again. At least I've had the pleasure of interacting with the committee a couple of weeks ago when we looked at the annual financial statements of the Corporation for Public Deposits. So thank you very much for the opportunity. I am accompanied today by our head of our Strategy and Communications Department, Mr. Kangani Matebula, who also takes care of our parliamentary liaison. And to my left is Mr. Heman Anderson, who is an assistant general manager in our financial services department, which is the area in the bank that has responsibility for financial administration accounting function. In terms of the presentation, with your permission, obviously members would have seen the report, which was circulated, but I thought I would just, by way of setting the scene for the interaction later, just quickly touch on the key functions of what the bank does, for just as a refresher, and then talk a little bit about sort of governance issues, give a brief operational review, after which then my colleague will then go a little bit into the financials, and after that would be happy to entertain any questions or comments or observations that members of the committee may have. As you'd be aware, we operate under the South African Reserve Bank Act, and the primary objective of the bank is to achieve and maintain price stability in the interest of sustainable and balanced economic growth. The key functions which the bank is responsible for include, first and foremost, the formulation and implementation of monetary policy. We are responsible for issuing banknotes and circulation coins in South Africa, supervising the banking system, which had elements of that we covered in the previous presentation. We also make sure that the national payment system functions effectively. We manage the official gold and foreign currency reserves of South Africa. We act as a banker for the government, and we, on behalf of the Minister of Finance, implement the remaining exchange controls, and clearly also act as a lender of last resort in exceptional circumstances in order to promote financial stability. I think given its very critical role in the South African economy and in the South African society overall, the bank subscribes to good corporate governance within a framework of operational independence and accountability to Parliament, which is clearly the reason we are here today. The affairs of the bank are managed by a board of directors, which consists of 15 directors, with four of them being executive directors, and those are essentially the governor and her three deputies are the executive directors of the bank, appointed by the President of the Republic, and the other 11 non-executive directors are appointed by both government as well as shareholders. Four non-executive directors are appointed by government, and seven by shareholders. Our board meets around five times a year and discharges its responsibility through a number of board subcommittee covering audit matters. There is a non-executive directors committee, there is a remuneration committee, and a board risk committee. The internal auditors, as good practice would suggest, have unrestricted access to the chairperson of the audit committees, and obviously to board members and to staff and to all records of the bank. So, and needless to say, from a governance perspective, that we are obviously committed to maintaining high professional standards, excellence, integrity, and want to be seen as a respected institution in South Africa and a beacon of stability. Our financial accounts, as talk about external auditors, are audited by two firms, PricewaterhouseCoopers and Seasons-Waluva for the period under review. They have renamed themselves through merger. I think they're called Gobordan-Zaluva now, I think. Gobordan-Zaluva. You know, we hold an annual general meeting of shareholders where we deal with various issues, including minutes, financial statements, where the board reports on the state of affairs and the business of the bank. We receive the report of the auditors there. The appointment of the external auditors dealt with at that meeting, and clearly the election of directors as well. And the key task, obviously, being also to approve the group annual financial statements there. And when we talk about a subgroup, just maybe to fill in the members of the committee there, the bank has four wholly owned subsidiaries, which I will just quickly run through. The Corporation for Public Deposits, which the committee is familiar with, given our recent interaction, which I chair, governed by the CPD Act, and with its role being to accept public deposits and invest them in short-term money market instruments, also run by an independent board, the chair of which is appointed by the minister. Then we have the two currency-producing subsidiaries, the South African Banknote Company, which is registered in terms of the Companies Act and obviously produces banknotes for South Africa, has similarly got its own board, which operates through various board subcommittees. That board is chaired by Ms. Kusum Kalen. And then the other currency-producing subsidiary is the South African Mint Company, which I have the privilege of chairing its board. Again, that is governed by the company list, and it produces circulation coins for South Africa and some other countries, and also numismatic products, mainly for the coin collectors market. Again, run by an independent board, as I indicated. And then we have an insurance subsidiary, the South African Bank Captive Insurance Company, SABCIC, which is chaired by my colleague, Dr. Mnyande. Again, a public company, a registered in terms of the Companies Act, and it carries out short-term insurance business for the bank and its subsidiaries. If you allow me, Chair, very briefly, I'm unaware people have got the report, but if I can just, borrowing from the report, very briefly run through a little bit of an operational review in terms of the period that we are looking at before then we get to the actual financials as such. And I will not touch on each and every function, I'll just pick out the more pertinent ones, starting with implementation of monetary policy, which entails the obligation for us to manage the money market liquidity, the domestic money market liquidity, such that liquidity conditions in the market are consistent with the monetary policy stance. That function has operated well during the period. We have managed to manage the liquidity appropriately. There's been no stresses in our interbank market. There's been no need for us to intervene in any way to support any institution or conduct any out of the ordinary operations because of any stresses or challenges in our money market. The conduct of open market operations that the bank gets involved with, which includes the issuing of sub debentures and reverse repos and conducting the repo system through which we refinance the banks, all of that worked very well through the reporting period. And there have been some changes to our operational framework so as to enhance the level of participation of some of the banks in our repo operations and in the open market operations, and all of that represented very important work, was taken through during the reporting period, worked very well. Another important operation, as you know, is the accumulation of foreign exchange reserves. We have seen during the year that we're reporting for reserves increasing from around 42 billion on the 31st of March 2010 to about 49.3 billion at the end of March 2011. And this was mainly due to foreign exchange purchases undertaken by the bank for the purposes of reserve accumulation, and with some impact also coming from valuations in terms of exchange rate movements and then the movement of the gold price. This successful strategy of accumulating reserves, which we've been pursuing for quite a number of years, has then resulted in the very positive development that at the end of June 2010, we were in a position to finally close out and repay the last outstanding loan facility that the bank has. For over a while, the bank had been involved in the international syndicated loan market and through bilateral lines of credit with international banks to supplement reserves. But as we were becoming successful and the reserve levels were coming up and reaching more acceptable levels by international standards, we could free ourselves from any borrowing. So at this stage, we don't have any borrowed reserves. Clearly, you know, with the amount of reserves that we've been holding, there needs to be a proper framework around the management of those reserves. And that management is guided essentially by three objectives. First and foremost, to preserve our capital. And secondly, to make sure that the reserves are liquid enough to be able to meet our needs. And lastly, also to make sure that we achieve a market-related rate of return within constraints, though, of a framework of acceptable risk parameters. The bulk of the foreign exchange reserves are managed by ourselves internally through our own portfolio managers in the financial markets department, but we have also outsourced a small portion of our reserves to specialist external fund managers who we control through very, very specific investment management mandates and very tight guidelines that we give them, where we also define very carefully for them the risk and return parameters that they can operate under. The governance structure of managing these reserves, which, you know, by now are just under $50 billion, it comprises a three-tier structure consisting of the Governors Executive Committee, which is the highest decision-making body in the bank, consisting of, you know, the governor, the deputies, and some senior officials. And the next tier is a Reserves Management Committee, which I chair, which is located in our Financial Markets Department, includes other people as well from the bank. And then during the past year, we have placed quite a bit of emphasis on enhancing the oversight role of this Reserves Management Committee through very targeted interventions from a point of view of upskilling the members and getting capacity building processes going. As I mentioned, on behalf of the Minister of Finance, the bank administers the day-to-day operations of the remaining exchange controls in South Africa. The policy remit sits with the minister, but the day-to-day administration is with the bank. All of that has gone very well, and the focus there has been a lot on dealing with administrative reforms, essentially red-type issues, and modernizing the framework to make sure that applications are dealt with much more easily, that the frictions in terms of exports and imports and limits that have been adjusted. So all of that was dealt with from a point of view of making it a lot easier for people to interact with the framework. So we focus on administrative reforms and reducing red tape there. The banking system and maintaining a stable banking system is obviously another very, very key component of the bank work. And the focus there to promote the soundness of the domestic banking system and to minimize systemic risk through the efficient and effective application of international regulatory supervisory standards. And the key, obviously, objective of the bank was to ensure that the legal framework for the regulation supervision of banks and banking groups in South Africa remains relevant and reflects local and international market developments and complies with the applicable international regulatory and supervisory standards. As you're aware, we are in the process of, and that started last year and is continuing, of readying the system for regulatory reforms that have come through as part of the lessons that we have learned from the financial crisis, and Basel III being the most prominent of those in terms of the requirements for higher capital and liquidity standards. So that's work that's underway in line with international developments. The bank conducted stress tests and improved its stress testing framework, which was refined, and there were also issues of asking the IMF to conduct a detailed assessment of the bank's compliance with standards. Whatever would have come out of those assessments, nothing major, there was nothing material in nature, but obviously these are things that then get migrated into day-to-day work of the department to make sure that we continue meeting these international standards. We participate from the banking supervision side in various international fora. We're a member of the Basel Committee on Banking Supervision. We are a member of the FSB and clearly also a member of the G20 South Africa, where a lot of the financial and regulatory reforms are being discussed. A colleague touched on briefly on the move to the Twin Peak system of regulation, which will consolidate macroprudential regulations in the central bank and leave market and business conduct to the FSB, a work that had been started through the during the reporting period, which is continuing now and gathering momentum, has seen a steering committee being set up to give effect to the implementation of the Twin Peak system, which is co-chaired by my colleague Lesetja Hanyaro, the Deputy Governor for Responsible for Banking Supervision, together with the with Mr. Ismail Mamonya, the Deputy Director General in the Treasury, and colleagues from the FSB. So work to continue enhancing and strengthening our regulatory framework in line with the paper that you would be aware of that was issued by the National Treasury, A Safer Financial Sector to Serve South Africa Better, in giving effect to those issues there. Clearly, financial stability in the wake of what we have seen across the world has gained momentum, and the profile of financial stability has risen immensely in recent times. The minister, just before the start of the reporting period, had given us a letter which more explicitly underlined the and reaffirmed the bank's key role in overseeing and maintaining financial stability. And I think it's important that, that, you know, we don't normally regard financial stability as the sole role of central banks, but a shared responsibility in which central banks appear to be in the best position to take a lead role. So it has become an increased focus of the bank, has resulted in us elevating the status of our Financial Stability Committee in the bank, which now essentially enjoys the same status as the Monetary Policy Committee. All members of the Monetary Policy Committee have now become members of the Financial Stability Committee, together with other key heads of departments in the bank, and this committee now meets also every 2 months in the alternate month of when the MPC meets. So financial stability, a very big area of focus in the bank. I will not sort of, those are sort of the key issues I just wanted to highlight, maybe a little bit on the research environment and the development there, because that's another key component of the bank. So we continue with our research agenda. We hold conferences. We had two very prominent conferences last year. The one which was in during the financial year that we're reporting for, the one was in November 2010, which had to do with monetary policy and financial stability in the post-crisis era. We managed to attract high-profile international speakers to this conference, and the second one had to do with issues around regulation, financial stability, and regulatory reform, which similarly was graced by a high level of international speakers who presented very interesting papers there. So, and in the normal course events, our staff members continue to produce papers that appear in international and domestic journals on our website, so that continues to be good work that gets done in the bank. And what we have seen again becoming an increased area of focus has been our international work, our participation in international and regional fora, starting with the Committee of Central Bank Governors in SADC, which is chaired by our own governor, to our participation in the IMF, in the G20, in the FSB, in the Basel Committee, and other fora. And during the last financial year, we took the first steps of enhancing our organizational capacity in that regard, and recently had approved through the executive the establishment of a fully-fledged department to deal with international relations and policy coordination. Of course, this goes along with the need for very strong and appropriate information technology systems, infrastructural support, business continuity arrangements, all of which need to be underpinned by a strong framework of internal controls, which we continue investing in and strengthening to make sure that we can support the work of the bank. Finally, just for this short operational review, briefly, human resources. All we do depends on having the right people in the right place with the right attitude at the right time. So we have continued to invest in our people through various training, initiatives, wellness programs, to make sure that we remain an employer of choice and attract the best that we can get in the country. The report sets out in quite some details with a number of tables, various permutations of our staff composition and component, but if I can just two or three highlights, this component, staff component is at the end of the reporting period, 31st of March 2011. We had about 2,101 people in the bank, which represented a slight increase from 2,033 at the end of the previous year in terms of the racial profile from employment equity perspective. We have managed to exceed the target that was set for 50%, with the 30th of March 2010, from a racial component there, us having a percentage of 62 and 63 at the end of March 2011. As far as gender is concerned, we were just marginally under the target of 50 at 49% at the end of March 2011. If we then briefly move on to look at, I'm back on your presentation now, at the financial performance. Our financial statements have been prepared in accordance with IFRS insofar as it is aligned to the SARB Act. The Act is not prescriptive in terms of what accounting framework we can use, apart from two specific cases which would relate to gold and foreign exchange, where the Act is quite clear as to how we need to account for that. But we have chosen to adopt International Financial Reporting Standard as a guide, and but to disclose instances where we do not comply with IFRS, such as the issue that I've mentioned regarding FX and gold. The bank incurred an after-tax loss of about 1.2 billion for that year, compared to about a billion for the previous year that ended on 31st of March 2010. And this was due essentially to the cost of holding our reserves because of the adverse economic conditions in financial markets. Basically, the return that we earn on our reserves is a lot lower than the funding cost of these reserves. So we essentially earn dollar, sterling or euro interest rates on those deposits and instruments that we invest in, vis-a-vis the funding of those reserves that happens at domestic rates, which is at or around the repo rate, which has come down over time to the 5.5% that we have now, but as you know, it's been higher previously. But I think it's important to state very clearly that in accumulating and managing foreign exchange reserves, the bank took decisions that were in the interest of the country and not focusing on its bottom line, on its profit, because we are not a profit organization. That's what we are set up for to do. So it is important then to highlight that what the losses that were incurred were very much in the execution of the bank's public duties and did not in any way relate to us not being able to manage our expenses or our budget or potentially taking undue risks in the management of those reserves. It is entirely due to this interest rate differential that I've just mentioned. These losses were offset against the contingency reserve that we have, which was created in terms of the SARB Act. It makes provision for us to build a reserve there. And it amounted to about 7.9 billion after taking into account that 1.2 billion loss. And clearly, when the bank eventually returns to profitability, we will need to rebuild that reserve again. Just leaping forward a little bit, we have seen that loss reduce significantly for this current year, which obviously we will come back report on at the appropriate time for the most recent period. Chair, if you'll allow, I'll just ask my colleague to run us through some of the numbers pertaining to our income statement and our balance sheet, and that will then be the end of what we've got to say, and we'll be happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Deputy Governor. Thank you, honourable members.
Just put on your microphone.
The summary of the statement of comprehensive income, for those who were previously it was known as an income statement, is on the slides, on the handout. It is also on our financial statement on page 67. Deputy Manelli indicated, we had a 1.2 billion loss for the year. You can see basically the interest income is less than the interest expense. The interest income basically is all the return we get on our foreign investments, that is revaluations, mark-to-market revaluations, as well as interest, and that is due to the or after the economic crisis that was just too low to cover the funding cost and expenses. I've also indicated that the group figures, the group, just to put it into perspective, to say that group, the Reserve Bank is 95% plus of the contributors to the group figures. The other subsidiaries, actually, if you turn on the next page, they contributed a 73 million a profit for the year, being the CPD, 53 million whose profits is to or was paid over to government in terms of the CPD Act. The SA Mint made a profit for the year. SA Banknote made a loss because due to volumes, the orders from the Reserve Bank in anticipation of upgraded series. At that time, the upgrade was expected, but we didn't know at that time it would be a total revamp. So the orders from the Reserve Bank were lower for that year, and Saabkik also made a small a profit, giving us a group loss of just over a billion after tax. A statement of financial position, that's a balance sheet, is printed on the next page with total assets. Once again, the bank's assets is the majority of the group. Very important figures. Our income statement and balance sheet is much dependent on the exchange rate as at year end and the gold price, because those two prices affect our balance sheet, the assets, which is gold and foreign exchange holdings, which is the majority of our assets, and the gold price has got an influence on the gold valuations and the exchange rate on the gold as well as all our other foreign investments. To come back to the asset side of the balance sheet, the assets of the bank increased by 32 billion. That was mainly driven by gold and foreign exchange holdings by 26.8 billion. And accommodation to banks of 5 billion. Accommodation to banks is basically overnight loans to banks. That is the facility where Mr. Manelli can tell us more how it works, but they can basically overnight borrow against security. Okay, the gold and foreign exchange holdings increased by 26.8 billion. As I said, it was increased currency deposits from National Treasury. The gold price increased from 8,000 to 9,000
700 per pound fine ounce, and the gold and foreign exchange, the first two was reduced by the valuation because the rand appreciated, so our so we get less. The rand appreciated from 7.3 against the United States dollar at 30 March 2010 to 6.8. That means we would get less rands for our foreign exchange. The movement on that goes to the Jafekra account. We'll come to the Jafekra account on the liability side. Okay. The group assets were only 9 billion higher than that of the bank, and that is mainly due to the CPD, which Mr. Manelli reported on, of about 8 billion. Investments by the CPD, and then property, plant, and equipment at our two manufacturing companies of 870,000, and inventories, basically stock in hand at those two manufacturing companies of 300 million. Our liabilities of the bank also increased by 33 billion, which is the main drivers are Saab debentures of 12.5 billion. Saab debentures is used in liquidity management tool. So that is used by the bank to affect the liquidity in the market. And then the gold and foreign exchange contingency reserve account decreased by 7.4 billion. That is an account used for all our gold valuation movements goes to that account. It doesn't go, like normal companies, to the income statement. It goes to the Jafekra account, which is basically a debt to government. But it's a reserve account for the account of government, which is governed by the Reserve Bank Act, and there is an agreement on which amounts will be settled on that account. But basically, it's since it's all unrealized or realized profits are invested again, so it is never realized. So it's a reserve for unrealized profits and valuations. And that decreased because of the appreciation of the rand. And then foreign loans and deposits increased by 31.3 billion. That was basically our client or government depositing with us foreign currency. So our foreign reserves increased, but we've got the liability against the National Treasury for foreign currency deposits. Once again, the group liabilities, the increase there, the excess of the group against the bank is mainly deposit accounts by the CPD, and then accumulated profit and reserves. I can just say both the banknote company and the mint are solvent. They've got both, between the two of them, they've got about 1.2 accumulated reserves. So although the banknote company had a small profit for the period under review, they are financially very strong. And that brings us to the end of the financial statements. I'm sure we can take questions on the operations, on the financial statements. And now, after tea, I'm not sure how the program is. Thank you, honorable members. I see there's a program, so I'm not.
Yeah, we are all human beings, so we're going to break for 5 minutes. Do what you want to do, grab your cup of tea, come back, let me proceed with Honorable Matudala is assisting us to correct. You must attend the other meeting with dealing with the installation at all. So I want to assist him in that promise as well. So we borrow. from other property members to research in our What time must you leave?
And I'm going to go to the next one.
Honorable members, can we take our seats, please, that we proceed? The honorable member from KZN, I know he's very proud of his province. Now we want to see if we can gain some time. Some of us have a 1 o'clock meeting and I want to do something else before what? Honorable members, I thank you for the presentations from the banking fraternity. It's very informative. From my side, to the Corporate Banks Development Agency, looking at your financial statements at the back, there's no notes to the financial statements. Referring to the Auditor General's report, emphasis on matter, although you received an unqualified report, irregular expenditure, fruitless and wasteful expenditure, but it's not noted anywhere. That's why I say notes to the financial statements is very important when you deal with the AG's report. So if you could explain that to us. And you mentioned the challenges, the CFIs. Except for giving workshops, etc., what else? How do you see the action plan? Because this is Parliament, in what way can we assist? You've got the opportunity to address us on that. The Reserve Bank is, in 2012, they are 91 years old. Over 9 years, we will have their centenary. Yeah. We went through a global crisis. We're now in the fifth year of the global financial crisis, and it's not over yet. And we can make projections every day, every week, every year. In the budget review document, it comes from National Treasury. But if something goes wrong in Europe, United Kingdom, or United States, we will need that turbulence as well. Your role as the bank, the leading bank in South Africa, in international fora, the role you play with regard to the BRICS, you've got a role to play there as well, as I see it. The African Development Bank is in the news. We've got the World Bank. The Eastern countries are looking at their own bank as well, as a group. That, if you could give us that picture. The rising food prices is hitting the consumer, but specific the consumer in the rural areas. What are your projections to speak to the high rise, the rising food prices? I do my shopping over the weekend, I assist my wife, and I look at food prices. It's incredible what's happening. You just stand aside and you look what the people are putting into the trolleys in the supermarket. So that's worrying me, especially the price of red meat. It's incredible. 118 rand a kilogram. It doesn't make sense anymore. Well, the person who is having that animal on his farm is not getting that money. That gap. We won't solve it yet. But we'll have to think about it. 2010, in the third quarter, inflation was 3.7%. In 2011, 4.8%. In 2012, it went up to 5.2%. In 2010, 171,000 jobs was lost. The point is, that's the question that we have to address as parliament, as parliamentarians, as committees, specifically dealing with finance and appropriations, about job creation. And that's where you play a role as well as a banking sector, specifically the Reserve Bank. So I'm just giving this short background, all the members. Any questions from your side? Thank you. In that order, to the different, to the two groups.
Thanks, Chairperson. I'm sorry to arrive late, but I'm having two, three questions here. Since the last time, I admired the document when you came. This one made of 20 rand picture. Okay. You remember, Mr. Manet. My question is, since the monetary policy is in place, this monetary policy is there in order to regulate the economy, but how often do you review these policies in order to have the integrity of the function of the bank? Number two, may you please comment on the inflation targeting and the employment target. Between these two issues, which one is the most common emerging economy in South Africa? What are imperatives like South Africa? Will you please also elaborate the impact of the Eurozone crisis in South African economy? Thanks.
Let's go down the road, Mr. Beck. Honorable Becker, please.
Honorable Chairman, I'd like to congratulate the deputy with the third presentation. I read through the report yesterday and yesterday night, and today I think I've got quite an idea of what's going on, and I think it's an outstanding report. Thank you for that. The other two reports, I don't want to go for the presentations, for the presenters, but I'm worried about if it's so vague. You're talking about problems, you're talking about issues that causing problem, but there's no values attached to it. There's no values attached to how big is that problem? How does it, what's the influence of it on your normal activities? And then I'm completely confused, as at the end you got from the Auditor General, you got a report, an unqualified report. So I can't understand that. I'm sorry, but I don't know what's going on there, and how big is the influence of it, and where does it stop, or where is it going, and all that. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, may I start with the first presentation where I was late, and my apologies for that. If we just drill down initially just to the figures, you made a comment, I'm not sure which of the two of you made the comment, about the Treasury holding back money and you raise accruals. So your balance sheet looks terrible. I mean, you've got liabilities of nearly a billion. Is it? No, a million, sorry. Okay, so for me it's a lot of money, but for these guys it's petty cash, I suppose. but the fact is, you've got liabilities of nearly $1 million, and current assets, current liabilities of nearly $1 million, and current assets of 150,000 odd. Marat, no, 50,000. I'm just needing to understand, if I were doing the balance sheet, I would also accrue income from National Treasury, if it was due to me. Because if you look at this balance sheet, you've now got the possibility of not receiving that National Treasury income. Because there's no, you know, and I haven't had it looked at the detailed report, if you could. Because you talked about money in the bank, you know, whose bank is it in? Is it, you know, I just need some comfort there. But a general comment about the operations of the cooperative banking. I mean, we've now managed to register two co-ops, as I understood it, one being somewhat interesting in the Northern Cape, but and probably not the target market, but nevertheless, it fitted the requirements, so that's fine. Where are we going with this from your point of view? You've said, and Honorable Becker and De Beer have indicated that you've indicated problems, but are we going to register one or two more this year, or are we going to register 100 more this year? I mean, is it really effective? Okay, your costs at 8.7 million, I suppose, aren't astronomical, but they could build a few RDP houses and a couple of other things. If this thing's not going to work, should we be persisting with it? Your salary bill seems quite low for 13 posts. I know you show one vacancy at 3.9 million, so it sounds like you're not paid very much, the two of you at the end there. And perhaps we need to, I'll be your trade union shop steward. If you need one, but it does, is that not a full year where there are a lot of vacancies during the year? But at 3.947 million, it doesn't seem to fit 13 posts very closely. So then, you know, there's an interesting one. Where I live is Ladysmith, and right next door to Spierkop Mountain, we have Twin Peaks. And Twin Peaks are so named because when you view them from a distance, they look somewhat familiar to those who might have seen the female anatomy. And I trust that there's no such analogy with the Twin Peaks that you're using. and that no one's going to feed off them in any way. But that said, in a lighter note, Mr. Chairman, in case anyone takes offence, please don't take offence. Right. With regard to SARB, you know, thank you for your presentation and some comments and perhaps some responses. The question of financial stability and creating the committee that mirrors the MPC is an important decision, I think. But there's clearly, if I'm correct, and you need to correct me, I know that the four of you are appointed by government, but there's no government intervention in that committee as far as I know. And yet financial stability is largely a factor of government policy. And I'm wondering how we can match those two, and whether you've got mechanisms in place. The question of your staff members producing papers, I think, is excellent. I really think it's fantastic. I was just wondering how much capacity or time they're given to do that. I mean, is it done in their free time, or like academics at universities, they take sabbaticals and they do it? Because if not, I think it should be done. But knowing your organization and the facilities for your staff, I'm sure you do give it, but I think it's something that's valuable. For the workings of the bank, as well as for the individuals, obviously. Now, I'm at a loss when it comes to the income statement, or whatever you like to call it, comprehensive income. Why did you pay tax on a loss? So, well, I, you know, I'm not really highly qualified when it comes to tax, so I'm sure you've got a very logical explanation, but just put my mind at rest. The $7.9 billion, now we all recall the kind of upheavals with shareholders a year or so ago and so on. And I'd please remind me, you've used the reserve to fund losses. What else can you use the reserve for? Can you pay out a dividend to the government or anyone else? I mean, just I know I should know that answer to that question, but please just humor me on that one. Chairman, my other notes, actually, I made notes as I was going along, but they've been covered by the presenters, so I don't think I need to ask any more questions. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
You may respond. Start with the cooperative banks and then the Reserve Bank.
Okay, Chair, I'm being asked to... just to come and answer some of the questions. So the first question from the Honourable Chair is on the fruitless and wasteful expenditure and the notes. On page 53 of the report, it does give the notes, but specifically to give an answer on the fruitless and wasteful expenditure, this was an amount of about 55,000 rand. What had happened here, I know, it's so page 55 of the actual annual report. Oh, that's okay. We apologize. We've got copies, but so we'll leave them. So what happened there, Honourable Chair, is that we had an employee who is from Zimbabwe. So he's working in South Africa on a work permit. We approved him to go overseas to attend a conference, only to realize that when he did his visa application, it took long in the embassy for him to get the visa. So he couldn't get it, and unfortunately the ticket was already paid at the time, so it couldn't be refunded and he didn't travel. So that's what happened there. There are two questions, firstly from yourself, Honorable Chair, but also from Honorable Makubela, about what else we're doing about the weaknesses that are taking place. This report was basically for 2010-2011, as you said. There is a lot of activity that we are happy to give you the final report that we're going to be releasing in a few months' time, but there is a lot of interventions we have made. For an example, just in relation to the skills, we have requested the University of Pretoria to set up a curriculum for the members of the cooperative banks that ranges from the operations of the cooperative banks to the management of the cooperative banks, even to the governance of the cooperative banks. And to design the curriculum, but also to provide teaching for them. We have paid the University of Pretoria to develop that, but we're also paying for the members to go and take their lessons from them. So we have, how many people have attended it? We've initially started off with 20 members. This is only started in late last year, and we'll continue with the program to provide the teaching for the skills development. But we also have a colleague who didn't come with us today, who is a director for cooperative banks. His only function is to make sure that he provides development and capacity building for this. Mm-hmm. And in the report, there is a whole range of activities that he has done to provide that kind of activity about that. So moving on to the second question that Honourable Becker asked about, Honourable Lees, about whether this really is working, why we only have two cooperative banks at the moment, where are we going with this? Yes, my view is that it is working, but because it's a financial intermediation we're talking about, our view is that we have to be careful on the number of cooperatives that we register initially. There is a bulk of development work and training work that needs to be done. Now, this is a very typical, the activities that they undertake, if you were just borrowing from what Ms. Matane said, it's typical banking. It involves taking deposits from the public. Mm. It involves loaning money to the public. It involves making inter-customer payments. Some of them even distribute social grants from the government into their members. Now, before we adopted this law,
many of them have collapsed. And the typical reason they collapse is a very simple factor, honorable members. Is that in some of the rural areas, and some of them in Ladysmith, have collapsed before 2002 simply because the majority of their members were saving their money for their Christmas expenditure, but also for the January expenditure for the school fees and for the Christmas spending and so on. So typically they would have societies or stock firms who would then deposit the money. But the managers, because they're not trained with liquidity management, they would simply loan out the money and not build up the reserves for their December withdrawals, which would rise up. So we've seen a lot of, many of them suffering from liquidity crisis simply because during the December period, when there are higher levels of withdrawals, they just don't have sufficient amounts of money to be able to put them out. So when David was talking about the capital requirements and why it's a problem to us, is that capital is meant in a bank to absorb those losses on a going concern, but also to be able to manage the liquidity during times of stress. So it's a simple thing that if you knew how to manage your thing, you would know in January already that you need to build up your reserve so that in December, when a lot of withdrawals are coming, you should just be able to pay them out. So it's a simple fact like that. But if you're not trained to do that, you'd find a lot of collapse in them. So our view is that we need to focus more on the skills development, at least initially, and then we'll register a lot more in the future. How many do we expect to register this year? It's difficult to give a number, but there are about two or three that are just about ready to register, probably even in the course of the year, if they were to meet the minimum criteria that we put. My view is that we'll probably register another two or three this year, but it's not a commitment we like to give as regulators, because if we don't, then we come this time next year, you're going to be asking us and said, you told us to. So we will say two, but probably not. Just lastly, on the materiality on the financial statements and the confusion that you have, Honourable Becker, on the audited financial statements. So we did not get a qualified opinion. So that means it's a clean audit opinion. But the auditors do find certain things which they call emphasis of matter. These are just things that they want us to go and resolve. It is clean. Let's just use the accounting words in terms of SAICA then. It's unqualified, but there are some issues that the auditors feel we need to resolve. And mainly, there's several of them, including some policies that did not exist at the time. But that was initially the one I spoke about the payment, but there was also the issue of the loss. Now, this loss that we're talking about, honorable members, it's not a financial loss. So the CBDA didn't lose any money. It's only that as the agency of the Treasury, we are a different legal persona. But in 2010, this was our first year of operating. This reporting year, this was our first year of operating. So we didn't have a bank account. So we had the money that the Treasury gave to us in terms of the budget line. But all our expenditure, literally all our expenditure, to buy a pen, to pay a salary, to do whatever, we needed to sign a requisition form that goes to the CFO of the Treasury for that payment to be made. And that included also the procurement of consulting services. But the Treasury closes off their books in a few weeks before the end of March, because that's the end of financial year. So there are certain people who provide services to us who were supposed to be paid at the end of March or beginning of April, depending on when they were supposed to be. So at the time of closing those books, when the Treasury closes their books, they also close our books, because it looks their own finances to look complete at the end of the thing. But when that happens, we still have invoices that we haven't paid. So they are a liability to us, even though we haven't paid them at the end of March. So yes, they were all paid, not all. There's one that wasn't paid because their tax clearance had expired. But they were mostly paid, but not for the reporting period that you show. So the papers you have in front of you would then say it's a loss, because there were invoices that we paid only after the 31st of March, which was not actually the case. So when the accountants look at it, they simply say, well, you've registered a loss. In accounting, yes, it is a loss, but it's not a financial loss. So that's basically what it was. None of it is material, honorable member. None of it whatsoever. Otherwise, we would have received a qualified opinion. So it's not a major issue for us. Thank you.
Just
Yeah, if I can maybe just respond on the issue of salaries. I think part of it as well was because, you know, as I said, this was our startup phase. I mean, at this time, we're about a year and a half old now as an agency. And so people are coming in, they were budgeted for the full year, but perhaps only came in halfway in the year. Some people here actually started 2 months before the end of this financial year, so it's all reflected as people working for the agency. I think also, perhaps that's also why this report reflects a lot of problems that are happening out there with the CFIs, was because in our first year of operation, that's what we really did. We went and we did assessments of what was going on the ground, because if we wanted to develop programs to help build these financial cooperatives, we needed to understand the environment first. So we did what we call benchmarking workshops. We went and did institutional assessments of many of these institutions to find the process. In a way, we're reporting all the problems we found. Of course, you're correct. Now what we have to do is find solutions to all these problems, and we've had to develop programs to try and overcome them. But just to give the members some idea of the size, as I said to you, CIPRA had 161 registered CFIs, which is a lot. But again, when we did an assessment of those, about 80% of those were less than 100,000 Rand in member savings. So very, very small, more stock village type. We had 18 applications, which means that there were 18 such institutions with 1 million Rand in deposits or more. And those are the ones that we're putting a lot of emphasis on the moment in terms of developing, because we think that those are the ones that ultimately are going to register as cooperative banks in the next 2 or 3 years. And that at the moment is our target, to kind of get these 20 going. And also, just to put it in the context, this fits into National Treasury's policy of inclusion, financial inclusion, and also trying to introduce more competition into the market, which is a little contrary to what the Reserve Bank likes. The Reserve Bank prefers fewer to regulate, bigger and fewer, whereas Treasury is beginning to say, no, we actually need more, we need more competition in the market. And these particular institutions are working primarily in rural areas where banks don't exist. Even now, there are no ATMs there, and many of the financial cooperatives we go to. So this is really the environment in which we're working, and we think that there is a market for them. But it does require a dedicated team working with that particular group, understanding the particular needs of those particular communities.
You can do the monetary stuff. I'll do the financial. To come to the question of dividends, that was dealt on the AGM held on the 8th of December 2010, to quote Ms. Marcus, in response to the seventh matter to be discussed, namely the basis for payment of the dividend to shareholders in the 2010 financial year, despite the bank making a loss in that year. Okay, what the board decided, they got legal opinion that accumulated reserves in terms of the section 24E that states that a 10% dividend must be paid out of profits of the bank, that accumulated reserves, basically the contingency reserve, qualifies for profits. It doesn't have to be for that year. It's not paid out profits for that year. Legal opinion was got, and so that is why dividend is paid. I think the bank off the record. Can we go off the record? I think the bank will be more than damage. You can overrule me. The bank will cause more damage in current times if we don't pay a dividend. It will be to save 200,000 Rand. And there will be more damage by not paying the dividend than to pay it. As Ms. Marcus stated, the board got legal opinion that the bank can pay out of the contingency reserve. Contingency reserve, you ask about that. That was built up over a period of time. It is in the discretion. The Reserve Bank Act says a 10% of profits must be retained as a statutory fund. The bank has got a statutory fund that is very small, but then the same provision says the bank can transfer before that a 10% dividend, 90% profits to government, can transfer funds to a reserve account, which banks do. That's the bottom of that. So the bank built up a reserve, a contingency reserve to almost 10 billion before the economic crisis. So we've got that, and that will see us through the economic crisis. And as Mr. Manelli stated, once we turn to profitability, we will reassess the level of that reserve before distributing our profit to government. To come to the tax, we are registered for tax purposes. That's another debate for some other time. But I think that had to do with the independency, to be independent from national treasury, to be a tax resident. There are central banks that are, there are central banks that are not. That tax we are not actually paying, we're providing for deferred tax. This is accounting entry. So we say we've got that loss. Once we make profits, these assessors, our losses build up with SARS. So if we make before we will be paying physically tax, we must first now make 1.2 billion profit, then basically we are equal. So we at SARS's records, we've got what they call assessed loss. So, and we work with future profits, we work that off. So that is a deferred tax provision on the, because ultimately of all our profits, SARS pay we pay 28% profits, and of losses SARS carry 28%. So that is that's a tax, actually an income of which reduces our loss. Okay, that's an accounting question.
Okay, thank you. Just maybe honourable just to build on what Simon just said before I got to the other complex. I certainly listen to the message and sympathize with a notion that asked the question why an entity that pays over 90% of its surplus to government anything should be paid back. But that's another thing. I can certainly it resonates with me.
They'll get together in a
and the issue, just to reiterate, in terms of the payment of dividends that Eamon alluded to from the perspective of whether that can be paid out of retained profit or whether it is retired due to have made a profit in that particular year in which you then pay the dividend, was indeed a subject of investigation that we as a board went and got ourselves comfortable with from a legal perspective. So it was fine, and there was no issue around any particular reason of bending the rules of being worried about it was very much in the ordinance of what we needed to do. So that was fine. Before I get to the question, because I thought a very excellent question, a few comments about the overarching framework of the chair.
You just touched on some of those, which I think were quite pertinent. Yes, indeed. The BRICS is a very, very interesting topic and a great opportunity for South Africa, and it's going to be really on us what we make of that. We are certainly at the Reserve Bank in terms of your question about the role that we play. We are involved in discussions as they pertain to the BRICS ahead of the G20 meetings that we attend. That is normally a BRICS a meeting that gets attended by central bank and finance ministry representatives. The agenda of the BRICS in many ways mirrors the G20 agenda. So we would normally meet before that and try to align our positions and try and find the common ground on certain positions that we would carry as the BRICS nations, as a bloc, into the G20, which then potentially helps us to, to gain more traction. So there is work ongoing. The lead in terms of our BRICS work is through the presidency and predominantly with the Minister of Finance playing a role there, and the bank in a supporting role. The issue of the development banks that you talked about, whether it's the African Development Bank, whether it's the regional formation in Asia or the World Bank, you are aware that the BRICS are themselves looking at establishing a BRICS Development Bank, and South Africa will play a very critical role in the sense that the framework that was agreed at the last BRICS summit was essentially handed over to South Africa to develop further with a view of a further report needing to be given at the time when the next BRICS summit is hosted, which this country will host. So the next BRICS summit will be here, and at that particular point in time, we would need to put on the table more concrete proposals around a BRICS Development Bank. So at least from that perspective, South Africa, in a way, is in a driving seat and has an opportunity to shape the agenda there, as opposed to responding to what others put on the table. So it's a big responsibility for us, but a great opportunity with regard to the BRICS Development Bank. The issue around food prices is a little bit more difficult, Honourable Chair. I'm not quite sure I can enter the fray as to how we get red meat onto your plate a little bit cheaper. But I think it's a food price. Obviously, are driven by a multitude of factors. The international commodity prices, which leads to various pricing mechanisms when it comes to issues such as maize and wheat, play a role. And there is, of course, the issue of input prices in terms of labour and the transport costs, fuel, and those things that feed into food prices. And, of course, the other big joker in this, which is climatic conditions, which obviously then can, from time to time, impact on demand and supply conditions to impact what happens. And then overlaying all of that comes then the issue of the exchange rate. And I may add that, for instance, in the more recent period, when food prices were going up quite sharply on the back of international developments, we were actually, from both the price and from obviously an inflation perspective, we were cushioned by the relative strength of the exchange rate when it came to international food prices pushing up. So that's some of the issues that I think also need to be considered when, and we know that there are very vociferous lobbies against the exchange rate and indicating how strong it is. So there are times when it actually has an offsetting impact. Similarly, what we're going to see in this next month would be the impact on petrol pump prices would obviously be also a function of you know what the exchange rate might have done and international oil prices. The issue which I will not tread on, which had to do with linkages between what happens on the farm and agricultural manufacturing versus retail food prices, that is a little bit outside. That's outside my province, exactly. It's outside my province because we don't deal with subsidies. That's a fiscal matter if that needed to be done. And clearly there are issues there of trade policy, there are issues of competition policy, and how efficiently things work. So I wouldn't want to tread on that ground. Further to the very interesting set of questions that Honourable Kuvela asked, unfortunately I couldn't oblige with regard to that paper that he wanted. The Honourable Member asked for. He wants to get hold of this paper on which we print the 21 notes. When I was here last time, so I told him that there is a principle that we're trying to enshrine at the banknote company, which indicates that people don't take work home and they don't give out samples. that's why we try to teach people there. So I can't oblige. Yeah, we're trying, and not always, I must say. The issue about how often a monetary policy framework gets reviewed, and that is it. There are reviews on a continuous basis when the operating environment changes. We are, for instance, at the moment in an environment where big shifts are happening in terms of the operating
environment of central banks. Whereas before the crisis, for instance, there was a notion that if central bankers concerned themselves with price stability, if they became super specialists in managing inflation and forgot about everything, the rest will fall into place. The crisis has told us that that doesn't work. That we need to look a little bit broader. We need to focus on financial stability, and we've seen sort of operating frameworks and mandates being adjusted to that effect, broadened to take into account use of financial stability, macroprudential, the tools and those kind of things, a big area of research and big shifts that are happening. And we've seen that over the years happen, in a sense that at some stage people were very sort of convinced that targeting exchange rates was a very good thing to do as part of sort of a monetary policy toolkit, and then they encountered constraints. At some stage, monetary targeting was a very, very sort of popular view, and then people figured out that it's very, very difficult as part of disintermediation and innovation that's happening, that there was difficulties in just measuring what actually constitutes money supply and what channels of transmission are used. And then eventually people landed on what appeared to be sort of the broad consensus around inflation targeting, was saying instead of all this intermediate target, let's go for the ultimate objective and target inflation. In between, in this country, there was something just before introduced inflation targeting called an eclectic approach. That was the last sort of policy before the change that basically went out essentially with the Stiles era, which was one that said it's getting so complicated, you know, let's target everything. Let's just use a whole combination of issues. But inflation targeting, I must say, then came out since it was launched. I think New Zealand was the first country to adopt it. It's been increasingly adopted by many countries. It then became the sort of the broad consensus of monetary policy. Even those economies or central banks that don't have an explicit targeting framework operate an implicit framework. The ECB doesn't pursue inflation targeting, but they talk about an inflation objective that's around 2% but below. In the last couple of months, we've seen the Federal Reserve System under Mr. Bernanke also adopting a more explicit inflation objective of around 2%. So from a point of view of the review, before I dwell too much on this, one thing I just need to highlight for honorable members to appreciate is clearly the delineation of responsibilities there. We distinguish between what we call goal and instrument independence. Instrument independence is what we have, but not goal independence. So we don't set our own goals. The goals, essentially in terms of the framework of what procedures get set by government in consultation with us, but the instruments in achieving that goal are then reside within our own independence and autonomy. As far as the inflation targeting framework itself is concerned, it has undergone some refinement since it was first launched in 2000. Initially, you'd recall that the target was meant to be 3 to 5. Post the exchange rate shock of 2001, it was then reduced to and taken back to 3 to 6. It was initially a target that needed to be met on average for a year, and you know, implementation then created some problems there. It got changed to a continuous target now for the range of 3 to 6%. At some stage, and these are sort of technical nuances, but just to show that there is constant review, at some stage there was a something called an escape clause, which then got changed to an explanation clause. So there's constant review, and when this tends to happen is ahead of the budget and the medium-term policy statement time. Whereas, for instance, the letter that I alluded to in my presentation earlier, which made financial stability more explicit as part of our toolkit, happened to have been published, the letter that the minister wrote to the governor. It is normal practice that ahead of the budget, ahead of the MTBPS, there would be these consultations that don't normally find their way into the public domain, where, you know, potentially if the minister
had any intention of changing the target or refining the framework, they would talk to the Reserve Bank, and that would obviously be part and parcel of also obtaining feedback from us as the people that work with the framework. How does it work? Can you implement it? What are the constraints? What might need to be changed within, obviously, those checks and balances that, you know, we can't just go and say, no, change it this way and that way, so we can always meet the target. Within sort of that realm of clearly delineating the responsibilities, there is a constant review of the framework. And some of it, for instance, has to do also with lessons that we've learned in the wake of supply-side shocks, which can be of an extended duration, where we felt that, look, the framework maybe might have not been conceived with those type of things in mind, where then the framework gets challenged. What then one does in the process is then to broaden and enhance its flexible nature, that you say, look, depending on what causes these shocks and all of that, you can afford potentially to be outside the target range for an extended period and extend the time frame within which you want to go back into the target, as opposed to then in a very rigid and very aggressive way tightening policy and affecting other variables such as growth just because you're supposed to be inside the 3-6%. That, however, needs to take into account what that would do to your management of inflation expectations and those kind of things. So the framework is adaptable, it's flexible, and it's subject to continuous refinements and checking whether it meets the objectives and continues to be appropriate. I guess the second one is a big one which could keep us busy for the rest of the day, but I'll be very brief on it in terms of inflation targeting versus employment targeting. As I indicated now, it's certainly the more common framework is inflation targeting, not employment targeting, because you asked, you know, whether, you know, in many countries. The difficulty with employment targeting, which is continues to be a subject of research, is that there are questions that one need to ask. First of all, what target would we be talking about? Which employment or unemployment rate, or what type of employment? Which sectors? What level? How do you define the target? So that's one big area that those proponents of employment targets have not quite told us. At this stage, we just say, no, they assumption seems to be that the target could just be a number, say, you know, so and so many jobs, or the employment unemployment rate at X percentage. But so the underlying measurement of what it is that you need to target, the next question would be instruments. Mm-hmm. Exactly. How do you get the time horizons and quite frankly, obviously, a lot of the issues that would be factors that would be outside what a central bank could control that would influence what happens to employment issues. There are things that obviously might be tricky in the process and painful to address that have to do with things like inefficiencies in government, electricity, supply constraints, issues that have to do with labor relations and all of those type of things, and labor market legislation and reform type of things. All of those feed into your big unemployment and or stroke employment debate. So it is a very, very tricky issue that not much, certainly as far as I'm aware, is available in terms of a proper framework that one could do. And the communication around it would also be very complicated in terms of then the transparency which need you to hold us accountable in terms of whether we're achieving those targets or not. So it's a difficult question, a difficult area. At this stage, we probably would need to know a little bit more in terms of what is intended there to be able to engage that more productively in terms of that move. My own firm belief is that we're very well served with the inflation targets and framework. Briefly, the impact of this Eurozone
I think the chair also alluded to it. We are, unfortunately, in many instances, the tail that moves with the dog. By the nature of South Africa being a small economy that is relatively open, with very strong links into Europe, just under 30% of our manufactured products go into Europe. They are a destination for our commodity exports. We have got very deep, liquid, and sophisticated financial markets. All of those things are creating channels of transmission, of shocks that would happen in that area. But it is quite rightly said, there is no way we could see things unraveling in Europe without having an impact on us. We're too intertwined with what's going on there. And in fact, the growth performance that we've seen has been very much impacted by what's happening in Europe and globally. So a lot of what's going to happen depends on the evolution of how the crisis in Europe gets dealt with, what solutions gets put on the table. The only worry, of course, is that when the first wave, when the first crisis came, it found us relatively well prepared. It found us with a very solid fiscal position. It found our banking system very well capitalized, and it still is. But to avert and combat that very, very, very strong negative development in terms of recessions, and you spoke to job losses, which were quite disproportionate in terms of what happened here. A lot of the policy space that had been created through that was used up. So if the wave was to hit us again, a big one, we haven't got as much room as we had previously. We certainly have more room than some other people have to be able to try and combat what might happen, but certainly you know, the good buffers that we had, unfortunately, we are not able to rebuild quickly enough, because what seemed like an emergent recovery got derailed by the events in Europe taking a turn for the worse. And I think, just to add, while people might be focusing quite a lot on Greece, I think certainly from a point of view of people in the financial market, but they've moved on. Their question is the steps after Greece. They're worrying about the contagion that would get into the banking system in Europe and the spillover that would then go globally, that could stem from problems in a country such as Spain or you know, God forbid, Italy, because we're talking, you know, very different numbers when it comes to that. So Europe, unfortunately, it's a big, big issue. And the other thing in the process that gets overlooked is that by no means is Europe the only source of vulnerability at the moment. There is a big crisis looming in the United States that is a little bit under the radar at the moment, which has got to do with a potential fiscal crunch that could happen at the beginning of early next year. In a sense that some of the special measures that were approved could be running out in terms of tax measures, which could force expenditure cuts, and that would obviously create a huge problem in terms of what the U.S. needs to contribute as a significant player in this game to world economic growth. So early next year is a potentially tricky time, and, you know, not to depress you, but it could coincide with a time when there's a change of administration and when potentially it's not that easy to make decisions and all that. So there are a number of risks. You would have been exposed to what is happening in China with a slowdown. We've had some announcements being made by policymakers about how they might want to create some stimulus, things about special provisions for you know, passenger vehicles, and they've opened up their financial markets a little bit more to make their currency a little bit more flexible. But certainly there are concerns about the slowdown that is happening in China, not just China, but the region overall. Japan and emerging Asia has also shown signs of slowdown. So our biggest risks at the moment are external in terms of what would happen.
briefly, not to overstay my welcome here, the issue around the financial stability, very valid points raised about the committee being inside the bank, but the financial stability function pervading, obviously, other areas. The way the link is being created there is that while the Financial Stability Committee, in its sort of newfound role at the status of the MPC, the issue that I was saying earlier on, the loop gets closed through something that is called the Financial Stability Oversight Committee. And that is a committee that is co-chaired by the Governor and the Minister of Finance, and includes other regulators and the FSB and the people that came there. So the Financial Stability Committee that was inside the bank, consisting only of bank officials, feeds information into the broader oversight committee, which then closes the potential gap that you receive. So that is integrated. The issues around our staff and the research that they do, it is very much part and parcel of their job. There are people that whose job is to do research, and we've got a very big research department. We are aligned with tertiary institutions. We sponsor the Monetary Policy Chair, the University of Pretoria. We have fellowship programs where academics come into the bank and spend some time researching specific topics of that. So clearly, that is a core function of what people do. So it's not a question of people, you know, compiling statistics and shoving paper and we expecting them, you know, in their spare time to do a bit of research. And our research is very much core of their work. So that's essentially what they're employed for. We've got specialist researchers in one of the larger departments in the Bank Research Department. Honourable members, you would have to remind me, I think I've covered the questions that were asked, unless I've missed anything.
Monsisi, I noted your hands. Also, Monsisi, is there a question you want to put?
Yeah, thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, can I apologize, please? Because
I want to complete this meeting at 12:30 at the latest, because we've got to run for other appointments as well.
Yeah, sure. No, it's just clarity, Chairperson. I've just been going through the presentation here. I was interested in the shareholders within the bank, that in terms of the volume or number of shares that they hold, are they able to influence the policy or direction of the bank? And secondly, whether you have foreign investors in the bank? And just lastly, in this big debate about job creation, where does the bank stand? What contribution does the bank make? Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I'd like to quickly respond to the question. And starting to take them in reverse order. I think that issue, we are very much committed to playing our role in South Africa in the bigger society. We are very much in the context of what is like, and in a way, going right back to the constitutional imperative in terms of the mandate, which enjoins us to protect the value of the currency and not as an end in itself, but you know, for a purpose to support sustainable and balanced growth in the economy. And in that, there is clearly an implied responsibility given that employment will come from growth. And sustainable employment will come from sustainable and balanced growth. So our responsibility is to make sure that we create conducive conditions in terms of ensuring stability in the financial system, stability of prices, the institutions that we take care of in terms of regulation and supervision, and that's really the best contribution that we can make. The banks cannot directly influence a variable such as the question of employment, but we very much do our role in terms of creating employment acting better in the mandate from the perspective of ensuring that we control inflation at an acceptable rate and allow the economy to grow as fast as it can. As fast as it can, as close to the potential rate of growth meaning that it can be that without changing the generation of inflation, which might then negate all of those gains that come from the world. And that's what we're saying. So that is the contribution that we're thinking of. That is quite apart from being the life of the damage and being a job and being an employer ourselves and making sure that
it's more passive.
No, it's in very direct in the sense that we absorb graduates from universities that come in and participate in skills development programs that form part of this international agenda of taking in unemployed youth into our employ for a particular period of time. We provide training for work and quality, not necessarily restricted to basic youth only. And more recently, as part of formalizing our corporate social investment activities, they very much include linking up with schools, with universities, with communities, and keep directly into the priority of the country. In as best as we can do. I like using this analogy of a puzzle where we say the reserve bank is one puzzle, one piece in that puzzle, and which needs to play a role, it needs to fit into a certain spot. But there are also other pieces in this puzzle that need to be arranged in such a way that picture can emerge. And so it is important in discussing these issues to try openly and frankly to indicate what it is that in this equation the central bank can do and what a central bank can do. How far it can support certain issues and certain others must similarly do what they need to do. So it's not something that we are too oblivious about or indifferent. We certainly are believing that in the appropriate space. The issue around shareholding, the bank, is a 2 million shares. They are owned currently by a group of 600 people who have how many shareholders we have. Your direct question about the influence of the bank, they have no influence on the management of the bank, and certainly no influence on policy. This is an historic relic. The rights that shareholders are left with currently go to the right to receive a dividend of 10 cents per share. And thirdly, secondly, they are entitled to elect shareholder representatives, which are indicated. So the board members are elected by but they are not in a position where they can influence policy as such, and people that invest in the bank, with notable exceptions that we know, which of course for the reason, don't do that with a profit motive or with a sense that they could enhance their wealth by investing in the bank. It's much more the spirit to support the work of the bank and to encourage what they're doing in the other part of the company. The issue of shareholders being in a position in any way to influence policy decisions of the bank, no. We asked another question about resident, non-resident, and foreign shareholders. There are a foreign shareholder, however, if you are not a narrowly resident in South Africa, there is a restriction in terms of how you can exercise your own, even for those. Some of the issues that we have done as part of the most recent amendment to the Act was to tighten the provisions of who actually is elected by private shareholders. We can actually sit on the board and much more clearly defined rules of who needs to constitute and satisfy the requirement of fit and proper to be able to sit on the board. So there's a nomination process, there's a panel that has the nomination from that group. So it would be three people at the vacancy, that will be put up to be then elected. So by the time that comes through, we have every confidence that the people that will come to the board will be able to join us. Will be people that are used to the board.
I think Chair and yes. Committee members, if I could just add, so for just for purposes of clarity, the question around shareholders sometimes goes hand in hand to with the ownership of the bank. I think we need to be very clear: the shareholders, whatever shares that they hold, are subject to limitations, which is one shareholder can only hold about 10,000 shares. And to be much more brutally frank, shareholders don't own the bank. The bank is a legal entity on its own. Mm-hmm. Neither does government own it. So those, I think those two things need to be very clear. However, even in the instance where they do elect board members, the act as it currently stands is such that they will never be able to have board members that will ever be in majority in any given instance, because government essentially appoints more than half of that board. So out of 15, government has about 8 seats, and the others are about 7. So I think that should be very clear in terms of our understanding of what happens there.
No, so they are very full control for one another. In fact, the speed in which the running minds are now in terms of stating that even within that voting pattern, it is not one vote for one vote. It's 200 votes that can be affected. Is there a limitation to share it with you? And, and the other issue also is that we have also defined a concept of associates, because some of the problems we had previously were people trying to circumvent the limit that has been mentioned now, only 10,000 shares by getting friends and family to own it. But where we can clearly establish that there is an association, that affects the vote.
Thank you very much, honorable members. Thank you to the leadership of the Cooperative Banks Development Agency and the Reserve Bank for their presentations regarding the bank. Reserve Bank, we dealt with this information also when we addressed the Sharp Amendment Bill. We went to much lengths to deal with that in public hearings as well, and taught a few people from outside the lesson how the processes works. Yeah, it just came back to me while you were addressing that point. Thank you very much for that clarity again. We're going to release you because the committee is now going to deal with administrative work. We're not going to keep you. If you want to stay, you're welcome. But we leave. So thank you very much for the engagement.
Thank you and your members for a very fruitful interaction and certainly for the support.